Dumbledore. Turn down the blue box the other end of the road before you try to babble the mission statement for Brick Liberation Radio. We're here to give a voice or a... No, we're here to listen, actually, to the diverse community. Consistent with the vision of creating an alternative, diverse, hybrid society free of sexism, homophobia, racism, all the forms of oppression, but just personally, DJ Mouse, founding member of Bolsheviks Anonymous, realizes only by appealing to higher than ourselves do we overcome our disability and be happy to be happy to be. Don't kill people, no matter what I may be reading about certain riches, but step on board the Stealing Christmas show from 104.1 FM, Berkeley Liberation Radio, and we are at berkeleyliberationradio.info, or if you can't find a website, there's always TuneIn Radio and Streama and some people love it kind of things. Knock, knock. Anyway, you're saying pause, but... Oh.
Marketed.
Little black people. And two, to give their valued operative a new cover for reinsertion in the African community. Primarily for intelligence gathering, gatekeeping, and an assumed leadership role with complete absolution for his crimes against African masses. That, in addition to the great laughter they enjoy watching us sanctify a sick, sadistic predator of African people, a vile tool who delights in the continued destruction of our liberation. But let's hear from the man Karenga himself talking candidly in a May 9th, 78 article from the... And that's where he says something about,
Christmas market. This touches me because I know that area so well, right? That the Kaiser Wilhelm Memorial Church, as I think I've said, maybe not on this broadcast, but on 9/11, I was in Berlin, right? September 11th, 2001. There I was in Berlin. I had just given my speech at the International Leibniz Conference at the Technical University. And 9/11 hit. We found out about it, what was late in the afternoon there. So all kinds of things went on, right? I stopped by the Berlin Cathedral, right? The Berliner Dom, right? In the island in the Spree River. And, talked to the to one of the people there. And then it turned out that at the Kaiser Wilhelm Memorial Church, there was an all-night service going on. So I thought it would be interesting as a reporter and also, from human point of view to go and see what it was. So there was the Lutheran church right in that blue octagonal building, right? Because the old church is a ruin, but then modern buildings have been put up there. And that's, I guess, the first time I saw them was in 1967. And the Kurfürstendamm, which ends at that place, that was the sort of Fifth Avenue or, fashionable street of the Cold War Berlin, right? Because the center of Berlin is really in East Berlin. But during the Cold War, they built up that part of West Berlin as an alternative center. And it was a very interesting place. So the idea of that kind of crime taking place in a town one knows so well and in a part of town, we have to look into it. Now, my thesis is growing day by day. This is a false flag. This is fake terrorism. This is something which cannot be explained by ineptitude or bungling or something like that. It looks increasingly like there's a concrete desire to have something bad, really bad, happen with the design of using that against Merkel. Now, this kind of an analysis doesn't depend on the political qualities of Merkel, good, bad, indifferent. It doesn't matter. If there's a false flag that has this capability, you want to know about it. And you want to know about it because Germany is the most important country in Europe, right? That's always been the case. And it's also one of the few islands of stability. In other words, the Merkel government right now, I think, still remains one of the only kinds of governments in Europe which is actually stable, right? The British, they have Brexit. The French, Hollande has collapsed. In France, Renzi is out. A new guy in, Gentilon. No, I'm sorry, not Gentilon, but a new prime minister. And so therefore, Merkel, right? And all we're looking for is stability, not chaos, but stability. And the modern state is proving vulnerable to all kinds of, what can we call it, hybrid warfare, color revolutions, sure, of all types. So what's going on here? Now, the news overnight is that the alleged killer, right, this guy Amri from Tunisia, has been killed. And he's been killed in northern Italy, not just northern Italy, in a suburb of Milan, practically in the city of Milan. This is a place called Sesto San Giovanni. Sesto San Giovanni is like the end of the line on one of the main lines of the Milan subway, right? Metropolitana Milanese can take you to Sesto San Giovanni. And then there are other trains that go even beyond that. But Sesto San Giovanni, it's kind of to the northwest of Milan. Northeast, not very far. It's on the way to Monza. Monza is where the, you know, Italian Grand Prix and all kinds of other things go on. Sesto San Giovanni was an industrial town. They had the Breda, right, the factory that built the Washington subway system, at least the cars, the oldest cars, the 1000 series. That's the Breda Finmeccanica or the Breda Meccanica. That's located in Sesto San Giovanni. And in order to get to Sesto San Giovanni, you've got to go to Milan, probably the main terminal, right? Milano Centrale. And there, from there, you can take the subway, or there are other ways to get there. So the story is that Amri was walking on the street in Sesto San Giovanni, and that he came up to two cops, and he had a backpack. So the two cops, seeing this guy come out of the station, they said, we have to check your backpack. And he pulled out a .22 caliber pistol, shot one cop, winged him, right, got him in the shoulder, and the other cop then killed Amri. Now, let's just go through some of this stuff. We are told now that the search was hindered by the fact that the very thorough and usually very competent and very reliable German police did not find the identification papers of Amri in the truck until 48 hours after the killings at the Berlin Christmas market were done. So that meant that Amri had a 48-hour jump. He had a 48-hour time advantage compared to the dragnet that was then going to come after him. And again, this is just – it's crazy. Amri is supposed to have been, you know, waiting, tarrying in Germany because they wanted to deport him. They had denied him asylum, said, you get out of here, you're getting deported. But they couldn't do it because they didn't have a passport for him. So they had to go through the process, or he did, of applying for the passport, getting that sent to Berlin, and then he was going to be kicked out of Germany. Now, it's beyond belief. It beggars the imagination that this stuff could be so impossible. Notice also that the German police, for some reason, got hung up on this Pakistani, and the Pakistani turned out to have apparently nothing to do with it, right? That was the final finding. Remember that Amri got control of this truck by essentially hijacking it. The driver, did he kill the driver? Anyway, the point was he had this .22, and he got control of the Polish-licensed truck and neutralize somehow or other the Polish truck driver. Now, here's the other thing, though, that Amri is an ex-convict with a criminal record who had been in jail. So he comes from Midwest Central Tunisia. He has a reputation for drinking, and it means alcohol, partying, and playing music. So he is secularized. But in March of 2011, Amri decides to make the plunge into the Mediterranean, cross the Mediterranean, and get over to Italy. He was convicted in absentia by a Tunisian court for stealing a car and was sentenced to 5 years in prison. Now, that should have been an Interpol warrant right there, but apparently not. Back in a minute on World Crisis Radio. Welcome back to World Crisis Radio. Remember, if you want to get yourself a gift, go to americansystem.tv, americansystem.tv, and you'll get our program from Monday through Thursday, 1 hour each evening. And I think the pace of world events, right, the zeitgeist. So Amri gets out of Tunisia just in time to escape a five-year jail sentence for stealing a car. Now, when he crosses the Mediterranean, he gets to the island. He doesn't even get all the way across. He gets to Lampedusa. Lampedusa. This is one you've seen on TV, right? The Pope visited it a little while ago, right, to show solidarity with these immigrants. But 4th of April 2011, Amri gets to Lampedusa on this rather shaky sea craft that he's got. Now, he then goes to Belpasso, Catania. So Catania is the east coast of Sicily, right? It's, you know, from Messina on the north east. Then you have Catania, the north center, and then Siracusa, right? Syracuse, the lower, the southeastern part. So what does he do when he gets there? He's guilty of arson. He burns down the entire facility. He's arrested in Belpasso. He gets 4 years in prison for arson, for causing a fire, damaging property, making threats. This according to the Italian Justice Ministry in the New York Times. Local news outlets report that three Tunisian asylum seekers, including the 19-year-old with the initials AA, Amri, were arrested for setting fire to the center where they were being sheltered to protest poor living conditions and delays in the processing of their asylum claims. And then he spends 4 years in six prisons. Now, I recommend La Stampa of Turin. They give you the itinerary. So he's in Belpasso in April of 2011. Then he's going to be in Catania. Now he's arrested because of burning the center in Belpasso. He's then shipped off to Enna, elsewhere in Sicily, and he's got all kinds of charges for him, and he's also got disciplinary measures inside the prison system. That's June 2012. Then on to Sciacca, another place in Sicily. He's in the this is now December 2013. He's in the Sciacca prison. Then he ends up in Agrigento, another Italian prison. So he's under special surveillance, uno speciale monitoraggio, special surveillance. Then Palermo, the prison in Palermo, September 2014. Then a different prison in Palermo for serious reasons of security. In other words, he's a very dangerous character. Then Caltanissetta, again, another Italian prison. This is May of 2015. Finally gets to Berlin, and then The next part is, as of the time that he has committed this crime, he's on the run. But even before that, he, as one account puts it, he bounced around Germany, North Rhine-Westphalia, Düsseldorf, places like this, right? Wuppertal, Duisburg, Mönchengladbach. He's always going back and forth between Berlin and North Rhine-Westphalia, right? As many people may still know it. So he's living in Berlin, and then he's been the police have a file on him as of March 2016. They've got a file on him, and they think that he's involved in drug dealings at the Görlitzer Park. He gets into a fight with another dealer, and he's ordered to be deported. Right? He wants asylum as of April 2016. June 2016, he's ordered to be deported. He's detained in Switzerland in July of 2016, just in this kind of a spot check. And he's held for 48 hours in a jail. Then he's released. And then he comes into contact. Now, here, let's just go through this. He's in contact with an ISIS recruiter. And this guy's name is Abu Wala, a Salafist preacher known as the man without a face. He never faces the camera when delivering video sermons. According to the Washington Post, authorities knew that Amri had interacted with Abu Wala, the 32-year-old of Iraqi descent, arrested in November on charges of recruiting and sending fighters from Germany to the Islamic State. So he's part of a conduit, right, of a delivery system. Key evidence in Wala's case came from an Islamic State, Daesh, defector who had returned to Germany and accused Wala of helping to recruit him and arranged his travel to Syria. So this person, again, arrested in Italy, arrested in Switzerland, but still somehow not possible. And now the capper is that after killing 12 people and wounding a good number, he somehow gets to Chambéry. Now, Chambéry, if you look at the map, look at the French-Italian border on the Mediterranean, and you go up, you start from Monaco or someplace like this, you get up to Grenoble, and you get up to Lyon. So sort of in that same area as Lyon and Grenoble, there's Chambéry, right? It's Savoy. This was Savoy. And there he is. How did he do it? Did he cross the border into France? If so, France is under a state of emergency, right? The cops can frisk you anytime they want. What's going on? And again, we would now ask Prime Minister Cazeneuve to enlighten us, right? The guy who he declared a state of emergency after Charlie Hebdo at the beginning of 2014. And then within a few months, then we have the Nice attacks, right? So that somehow the state of emergency doesn't mean anything. And then that got our friend Amri to, from Chambéry to Turin, right? Torino. How does he do it? And then from Turin to Milan at the Centurion. And then finally, Cesto San Giovanni, back in a minute on World Crisis Radio. Welcome back to World Crisis Radio. So you get the idea. Amri goes where he wants, even with Moritz. And very important is, what's in Sesto San Giovanni? Why there? It looks like this might be comparable to those little places in Belgium, which have sort of lost their economic vitality. Sesto San Giovanni used to be industrialized, right? As I said, it used to have the Breda. It used to have other important industries, and that all collapsed, and now they're trying to limp along with this, you know, rubble service economy, right? The junkyard of the post-industrial world. So why is he going there? It's understood that the Italian authorities are now essentially putting resources they have into, you know, checking out what is it that he thought he'd find in Sesto San Giovanni. Is there a safe house there? Whatever is it? So again, La Stampa, important because they're scared, right? He came through their town, and therefore they give you this fairly detailed story, right? So the Berlin killer is dead in a suburb of Milan. And I have to call attention to this, right, that there's so much irregularity here. Looking at the Frankfurter Allgemeine Zeitung, right, the main conservative paper in Germany. We don't need to go through it, but there are all kinds of people now calling for increased scrutiny, right? It's clear that the Merkel government is going to come forward with new measures, right? They're going to ask for, I suspect, more use of these closed circuit television cameras and related things. But I'm going to be very interested. I know people who yell false flag every time the sun comes up, right? They just that's their you know default reaction, right? Whatever it is, it's false flag. And I'm saying this really is a false flag. This is so suspicious that it cries out to any serious observer.
Now we're going to go to controlled opposition, United Slaves to Arab Sting and Occupy, 1229 50 Mile Street border. So that was a year ago. I always do what I did last time, or I always did it better last time, but I can't play last week's show because I didn't really do anything. I just redid the little Mumia rally better because I didn't chop off the perfect statement. The fact is we know he's innocent. No. The fact that we know he's innocent means we must do it. And with a little goddamn determination, we will do it. Free Mumia. Okay, so sorry, Gerald, for messing up the Mumia rally 12-9. 16 here at OG Plaza, but I did do it last week. So this week, I'm stealing Christmas and reading from Controlled Opposition, United Slaves, Everything, and Occupy, Token Everything, the House Report. And what was that thing about the Grinch? Well, I'm just going to go back to the beginning. You heard a little bit of the end there. DJ is new at the job, and I've got so many windows open. I've got to go to controlled opposition until you start speaking. Speak to me, unless I'm back the, it'll pop up. It'll start.
So this is the Mouse Report, 104.1 FM, Berkeley Liberation Radio, wherever you can find it. Let's see, Streama, TuneIn Radio, maybe a few other places. And, of course, first and third Thursdays are meeting where you can join if you're willing to do a little.
Breaking the law, breaking the law, breaking the law, breaking the law.
Brook, working with the LAPD's CCS Criminal Conspiracy Section and Division 5 of the FBI that we know from 11-22-63. Oh, yes, and a document talks about Division 5 blowing our brains out and the version of JFK. Use certainly newly Africanized and modified recruit. Sorry, Judas Priest. Oh, Gospel of Judas coming up in a bit, but
maybe you'll have to wait a whole year to hear about you will sacrifice the man who clothes me. Now, that's what I told my dentist when he was criticizing me because he needed to use so much Novocaine. But I said, well, how would I understand the Gospel of Judas unless I look down into my open mouth? And full profile silhouette on Bailey. You'll sacrifice the man who clothes me, obviously, a pertinent line to come from the favorite disciple, and actually, so was Jesus, because the master was Mary, of course, but that's a different show, too. It's Star Bunny, but this is the Grinch Stealing Christmas.
Maybe not this show. Modified recruits set up two primary synthetic terror groups known as the U.S. Organization with police agent Ron N. Everett, a.k.a. Ron Karenga, and the SLA, or Symbionese Liberation Army, with police informer and provocateur Donald DeFries. According to CCS police snitch and provocateur Louis Tackwood, Ron Karenga and his U.S., later known as United Slaves Organization, were funded by Ford Foundation, LAPD, and his good friend Mayor Sam Yorty through municipal funds. Financing to the tune over $50,000 a year, plus two offices, five apartments, as indicated in the September 6, 69 edition of the Black Panther newspaper. Wall Street Journal revealed Karenga maintained close ties to the Eastern Rockefeller family, and that a few weeks after the assassination of Martin Luther King, Mr. Karenga slipped into Sacramento for a private chat with Governor Ronald Reagan at the governor's request. Black nationalists also met clandestinely with Los Angeles Police Chief Thomas Redden after King had been killed. Louis E. Tackwood was a liaison man between Karenga and DeFries and LAPD's CCS division, aptly named the Criminal Conspiracy Section's sole purpose and agenda was to target and destroy black militants and their organizations through conspiracies involving informers, Asian provocateurs, programmed assassins, and setup men, as well as militant synthetic terror groups to sabotage and discredit the African liberation movement in general. Through Tackwood, Ron Karenga and his United Slaves, we should have known they were punks by their expletive name alone, were given their assignments to work in opposition to other black groups within the black community, which attracted large numbers of blacks. Now I'm reading from agentfiles.tumblr.com/48440802/CIA informant Ron Karenga rat 416 NZA Kwanzaa.
Which is my segue back to the world crisis. Until he runs into the same goddamn Christmas stuff, I'm going to segue back to the Grinch-stealing Christmas. Here's the world crisis. Here's the Turpleaf.net's take on the Berlin. Obviously, attack on Merkel. She's from East Germany originally, and can speak to Putin. Like, they can take either language, but that's, never mind.
So the VATS, right, the Frankfurter Allgemeine Zeitung, is full of stories about how security measures are going to be increased and so forth. And I think one of the things you have to do is look at these networks, right, because it is here we go. The Nach der Fahndung viele Fragen. So after the dragnet, there are lots of questions. Yes, I dare say they are. After the death of the suspected perpetrator of Berlin, many people are breathing easier, but the investigation is going further and on. What was the path that Anis Amri took towards Italy. That's only one of the unanswered questions, right? There, as we've just gone through, there are a million. The thing is a total chaos. And again, last word on this. The cui bono, who benefits? Cui bono, the enemies of Merkel. It's clear. So who are they, and how might they have helped along the results that we have? All right. Now, I guess the world is what it is. How about changing gears and thinking about the season and maybe about the weather and winter and a little bit of cultural background? Now,
on the point of what the Grinch is doing, I click pause, so hold on. There may be need for some of your take on the season that we're stealing and the control of opposition, etc.
Should have known they were punks by their name alone, given assignments to work in opposition to other black groups. Karenga was directly ordered to, quote, curtail the Panther Party's growth, no matter what the cost, and that no orangutan CCS slang for U.S. members. That's what we called his people would ever be convicted of murder, unquote. Gag. Techwood also stated that he provided Karenga with assassination orders from the FBI to kill Panther leaders Elmore Geronimo Pratt and apprentice Bunchy Carter. Well, they got Carter. Of course, Geronimo Gijaga was freed after proving all this because they knew he was in Oakland when those tennis court murders went down.
Talk was interrupted by the inability to proceed because of the murder of one of Oscar Grant's friends.
He was framed for, meaning that the LAPD and complicit Oakland people on the inside were guilty of those murders in conspiracy. Why target Bunchy Carter? The Southern California chapter of the Black Panther Party was formed in 68 by apprentice Bunchy Carter. Carter was the former head of the 5,000-strong Slauson Gang and its hardcore unit, the Slauson Renegades, and was known in the area as the mayor of the ghetto. While spending 4 years in Soledad prison on charges of armed robbery, he became a Muslim and follower of Malcolm X. In 68, Carter met Black Panther Party Minister of Defense Huey Newton and immediately became a Panther on the spot. Newton recognized Carter's formidable organization and leadership skills and tasked him with forming and leading the Southern California BPP chapter. In early 68, he was given the revolutionary position of Deputy Minister of Defense. Mae Brussel on Ron Karenga, originator of Kwanzaa, quote, Black leader of the U.S. organization. In December 67, Detective Sergeant R. Farwell recruited Donald DeFries to work for the Public Disorder Intelligence Unit of the CCS, Criminal Conspiracy Section, LAPD. Its purpose was to monitor black political activities in California. Karenga worked with DeFries and the LAPD as part of a, I'll say it, fuck unit, running guns to various black militant groups, hoping to set off a gang war between Black Panthers and the U.S. organization. U.S. member Melvin Cotton Smith helped set up Black Panther bus for the police. The Steiner brothers, working with Karenga and LAPD, killed Panther leaders John Huggins and Alprentice Carter at UCLA. Unquote. That was Mae Brussel. Members of Karenga's group were at Vacaville with DeFries. And then HTTP... Mae Brussel.com/Mae Brussel articles. Why was Hearst kidnapped? On January 1769, Jerome Higgins, 23, and Alprentice Bungie Carter, 26, were gunned down by Karenga's men, George P. and Larry Joseph Steiner. Harold Jones, Donald Hawkins, and the trigger man, Claude Chucheza Hubert. Larry Steiner was wounded in the shoulder from a shot squeezed off by Alprentice Carter. And the three of them made their way back to the getaway car driven by their FBI handler, Brandon Cleary, also known to them as Control One. According to a police agent codenamed Otello, most likely either DeArthur Perry, a.k.a. Ed Riggs, or Louis E. Tackwood, Cleary drove three of the assassins back to the FBI building in Los Angeles, where they met in a 14th floor office for debriefing. The FBI then facilitated gunman Claude Hubert's escape, as Hubert was subsequently transferred to an East Coast office of the Federal Bureau of Investigation. In New York City. Hubert has never been apprehended and is believed to be currently living under Bureau cover. As for the Steiner brothers, they were ordered to turn themselves into police, whereupon the Bureau would assist them when things quieted down. After their reported surrender, the Steiner brothers were tried and convicted of the murders of Carter and Huggins. They were sentenced to San Quentin, a maximum security prison. 4 years later, as, quote, model prisoners, unquote, the two were transferred to the minimum security section of the prison. The FBI made good on their promise and facilitated their escape in 1974 during a conjugal visit arranged for both. Aided by a black prison guard, the two were literally allowed to just walk off, and their handlers and the FBI assisted in providing them safe transit and haven in Guyana, South America. One has to wonder what Larry Steiner knows, and if his services were utilized further in nearby Jonestown, as he was in Guyana during that time. His brother George eventually left Guyana, and his current whereabouts are an FBI secret. Larry, however, changed his name to Watani, married, and moved to neighboring Suriname. After civil conflicts threatened his family and great new life, he called his handlers with a request to return to the United States in exchange for granting political asylum for his family. This scumbag, traitor, and FBI snitch returned in 94 and was double-crossed by his masters, who arranged for him to finish out his life sentence.
Well, of course, not mouse report listeners, more so than 104.1 FM listeners know that, of course, Patani was on our very airwaves explaining the fracas, I will call it, perhaps inaccurately, but an assault against a woman was the pretext to bring them in, okay? So obvious dupes are explaining some of the details, and this is all good. We need to guard these people with our lives.
Who was Otello? Depending on sources, he was either DeArthur Perry, a.k.a. Ed Riggs, or Louis E. Tackwood. From 68 to 75, he was a paid undercover operative for the FBI and committed many of the crimes that the congressional committees and Justice Department failed to uncover. Otello was a code name given to him by the FBI and committed many, given him by the FBI, who ultimately became so pleased with his performance they gave Otello $2,400 a month in cash payments and expenses, making him one of the Bureau's highest paid and therefore one of his most valued operatives. As FBI documents released under the Freedom of Information Act years later revealed, there were at least 295 FBI operations against black groups up to the year 1971. Of that total, 233 were specific operations launched against the Black Panthers. The Bureau wound up spending an estimated $7,400,000, much of it on operatives like Otello and informants and undercover men to wreck the organization. That amount is about double what the FBI was spending to obtain information about organized crime. Meanwhile, back at California Medical Facility at Vacaville, a covert mind control unit with funding from the CIA channeled through Stanford Research Institute, these mental park behavior modification specialists experimented with psychoactive drugs administered to members of the BCA. black prisoners were programmed to murder selected black leaders once on the outside. The CIA SRI zombie killer hit list included Oakland school superintendent Dr. Marcus Foster and Panthers Huey P. Newton and Bobby Seale, among others. Working with some white CIA associates, Westbrook was now very busy mobilizing his BCA hypno soldiers into a violent paramilitary synthetic terror group.
So it should be noted that Marcus Foster opposed the school ID program, was working with Huey, and so this pretext that these guys, this bogus front group used, is so transparent. I mean, even the Gallo, you know better than buying Gallo to smash Stephen Weed in the face. So.
Known as the Symbionese Liberation Army. Among them, a pathetic loser named Donald DeFries stood out. From 67 to 69, he worked as a police informer for the Los Angeles Police Department under Detective R.G. Farwell, Public Disorder Intelligence Unit. At the time, the LAPD was supplying weapons to independent black agents and the United Slaves, U.S., hiring them to specifically kill Black Panthers. DeFries worked closely with police agent provocateur Ron Karenga, head of the U.S. organization. Later, other members of Karenga's group were programmed at California Medical Facility at Vacaville with DeFries. DeFries stated that at Vacaville in 71 to 72, he was the subject of a CIA mind control experiments. Now, yeah, that call he made where Patty talked about the fascist insect, he fingered Colston Westbrook, and that's when they got burned alive. And that's what grossed Michael Rupert out, and he defected from the killer establishment.
And then along with Robert Nye, John Judge, and Peter Matheson, all exited within about a month.
He joined what the CIA author of On Company Business called the Wimkeys, Defectors from the White Man Killer Establishment. But back to CIA informant Ron Karenga, RAT 416 NZA Quanta. He described his incarceration on the prison's He described his incarceration on the prison's third floor, where he was corralled by CIA agents who drugged him and said he would become the leader of a radical movement and kidnap a wealthy person. Prior to Vacaville, nothing in DeFries' background indicated a political consciousness while he worked as a police intelligence informer. Shortly after his arranged escape from Vacaville, an exit door was left unlocked for him. That's exactly what he did, following his programming on cue. Colston Westbrook co-opted the works and revolutionary writings of the genuine African prisoners movement and incorporated them into the teachings of the BCA. DeFries, his star pupil, was even allowed to set up a subgroup called Unisight to refine his program leadership role in the Symbionese Liberation Army. Earlier, Westbrook had invented Ron Karenga's United Slaves logo with the seven-headed cobra, along with accompanying Swahili principles incorporated at each head. Umoja, Kuji, Jagalia, Ujima, Ujama, Nia, Kumba, Imani. You may know these now as the seven principles of Kwanzaa. After Karenga's conviction and the U.S. United Slaves were no longer of any practical military intelligence use, Colston Westbrook revamped the United Slaves' seven-headed cobra and principles and grafted them into his new group, the Symbionese Liberation Army. DeFries, who now changed his name to Sinku or Sin, would be the leader of a group who consisted of five white intelligence assets and a Negro operative named Ciro Wheeler. Wheeler met DeFries earlier when they were both prisoners at Vacaville in 72, and Wheeler was placed as an inside handler to manipulate both DeFries and Sinku and the rest of the SLA. Ciro Wheeler was later transferred to San Quentin, and to facilitate his activation in the SLA, he too was allowed to just walk away from his imprisonment in August of 73. Another unusual development with intelligence connections was the sudden appearance of a man by the name of Bernard Keaton, who was secured as an actual double agent for for Donald DeFries. Keaton surfaced in spring 73 after DeFries walked away from Soledad and claimed to be Donald DeFries. As cover, Keaton moved in with DeFries' family friend, Reverend R.W. Foster, and family in Buffalo, New York. Keaton's impersonation was so good that he was even familiar with intimate details of the family history that only DeVries would have known about. The only reason for having Keaton as a double was in case the law enforcement officers in the Bay Area had accidentally picked up DeVries during the time between his escape from Soledad and the kidnapping of Patricia Hearst. Then, if necessary, his double could have taken his place in prison. 3 long years had gone into training DeVries for this mission while at Vacaville Medical Facility, and it couldn't be afforded to be jeopardized. Later, when the FBI was challenged about Bernard Keaton being DeVries' double, the FBI stated they are not concerned or even curious about him and stated that it isn't illegal. When the CIA, FBI, CCS decided that the SLA had outlived its usefulness and DeVries' programming was coming apart more and more, their terror group, the SLA, needed to be publicly eliminated. Wayne Lewis and the FBI agent provocateur reported that the FBI had asked him to replace DeVries 2 weeks before DeVries' death because, quote, the FBI was going to kill him, unquote. The police and FBI then carefully arranged for their select operative, Cyril Wheeler, Emily and William Harris, and Patricia Hearst to be secretly secreted out to safety and surrounded the SLA safe house. As soon as Cyril Wheeler and another, Negro punk, made sure others remained in the house for sacrifice. The cleanup operation began in earnest. Donald Agent Gray of the FBI shot DeVries in the back from a position just outside the house. Then a fusillade of bullets were fired into the house and the structure set ablaze on national TV. DeVries and 5 other SLA members were calculatingly incarcerated along with any telling critical evidence. The LAPD did not notify DeVries' family of his death for 3 days. His remains were sent to them in Cleveland, Ohio, with both the head and the fingers missing. I can only imagine that if a proper and thorough autopsy were performed specifically on the brain tissues, it would have been revealed evidence of any chemo surgeries, physical surgery, psychoactive chemical residues, and or electrode experimentation. It was either that or the body they had was actually Bernard Keaton, the double for DeVries. It was alleged that directly after the cleanup operation, the CIA demanded possession of DeVries' head. Ron Karenga was convicted of 2 counts of felonious assault and 1 count of false imprisonment for his role in the imprisonment and grievous torture of 2 African women named Deborah Jones and Gail Davis. A May 14, 1971 article in the Los Angeles Times described the testimony of Deborah Jones, who once was given the Swahili title of African Queen. Said that on May 9, 1970, she and Gail Davis were whipped with an electric cord and beaten with a karate baton after being ordered to remove their clothes. She testified the hot, smoldering iron was placed on Miss Davis's mouth and placed against Miss Davis's face, and that one of her own big toes was tightened in a vice. Karenga, head of U.S., also put detergent and running hoses in their mouths. She said additional evidence and testimony surfaced that indicated that the following day, Karenga allegedly told the women, "Vietnamese torture is nothing compared to what I know. CIA torture lessons from Westbrook and the Phoenix Project, no doubt." One of 2 cohorts, Luz Maria Tamayo, reportedly put detergent and a caustic substance in the women's mouths, and the other, Louis Smith, turned a water hose full force on their faces with Karenga holding a gun and threatening to shoot both of them, Jones and Davis, unquote. Karenga was also found to have burned Davis and Jones with lit cigarettes and inserted a water hose into them, their vaginas, and sadistically forced cold and alternately very hot water into them. Seeing that this could lead to a real stretch in a real prison, Karenga didn't want to do hard time in a regular prison, so he feigned insanity and beseeched his covert masters for their help. Quoting from a transcript of Karenga's sentencing hearing on September 17, 1971, quote, "A key issue was whether Karenga was sane. Judge Arthur L. Alarcon read from a psychiatrist's report, quote, since his admission here, he has been isolated and has been exhibiting bizarre behavior such as staring at the wall, talking to imaginary persons, claiming that he was attacked by dive bombers and that his attorney was in the next cell," unquote. During part of the interview, he would look around as if reacting to hallucinations, and when the examiner walked away for a moment, he began a conversation with a blanket located on his bed, stating that there was someone there and implying indirectly that the someone was a woman imprisoned with him for some offense. This man now presents a picture which can be considered both paranoid and schizophrenic, with hallucinations and illusions, inappropriate affect, disorganization, and impaired contact with the environment, unquote. Either he was faking for a reduced sentence or some BCA programming was going haywire. In any event, he was sentenced on September 17, 71 to serve 1 to 10 years in California state prison named California Men's Colony in San Luis Obispo, California. His handler stepped in once again, and he was later transferred, get this, to the California Medical Facility at Vacaville for possible deprogramming or reprogramming. Brother Spartacus of Gap Radio asserts that it's possible that Karenga may have never even served the sentence in the prison at all, and that his masters in the FBI may have arranged for fake prison records to be generated at the facility of his alleged prison term, which is something to ponder considering how valuable he was to them and is to them now. Since then, the FBI's anti-African COINTELPRO strategy continue uninterrupted and has been expanded and instituted globally with new names such as Toplev, Comtel, and CERMCON. A brief account of the sentencing ran in several newspapers the following day. That was apparently the last newspaper article to mention Karenga's unfortunate habit of doing unspeakable things to black people. After that, the only coverage came from the hundreds of news accounts that depict him as the wonderful man who invented Kwanzaa. Karenga was released a scant 3 years later in 74, and his handlers in the CIA and FBI set him up to be chairman of the Department of Black Studies at California State University, now named Professor Maulana Master Teacher Karenga. He later resurfaced with the resurrected SLA principles and dubbed them the Seven Principles of Kwanzaa, complete with an Africanized Hanukkah menorah called the Kinara. His handlers in the FBI thought that this would serve a twofold purpose of the establishing and marketing a synthetic African holiday with a convoluted African origin that would serve their financial agenda as an alternative Christmas marketed directly to black people, and two, to give their valued operative with a new cover for a reinsertion into the African community, primarily for intelligence gathering, gatekeeping, and an assumed leadership role with complete absolution for his crimes against African masses. That, in addition to the great laughter they enjoy watching us sanctify a sick, sadistic predator of African people, a vile tool who delights in the continued destruction of our liberation. But let's hear from the man Karenga himself talking candidly in a May 9, 78 article from the Washington Post. People think it's African, but it's not, he continued. I came up with Kwanzaa because black people in this country wouldn't celebrate it if they knew it was American. Also, I put it around Christmas because I knew that's when a lot of young black people, would be partying. We need to make a revolutionary choice at this point and either continue celebrating a holiday given to us by our enemies, a holiday that amalgamates Christmas and Hanukkah with a synthetic African characteristic inserted strategically for 7 days right after Christmas. Kwanzaa was an African Trojan horse to continue an unofficial celebration of the Christmas season and redirected our hard-earned money back into the enemy's coffers. To depart a legend and give absolution to a traitor African masses should have judged and gave a death sentence for crimes against African people and our struggle. Kwanzaa is now as commercially viable a commodity as Christmas, generating millions in greeting card sales alone. It's clear that a number of major corporations have started taking notice and trying to profit from Kwanzaa, said a San Francisco State Black Study professor, Oba Tshaka. Let's stand as one and salvage the good from Kwanzaa, then give it a burial and develop our own day that Africans around the world can look up to in pride and united in celebration. A day that serves our collective interests and enriches the revolutionary traditions of our race. A day that our enemies will revile, a day that frees us from their shallow trappings and venal exploitations. That's from Agent Files, CIA informant Ron Karenga Rat. Let me copy that before I get rid of it, because do not crash this song.
And who's the fool who wears the crown?